NBA on NBC.
What is NBA up, everybody? Finals. This is Jim Mylak, and you're listening to Pot of Fame, the podcast where we break down former athletes and decide whether or not they should get a call to the Hall. On today's podcast, we're talking about former Kansas City Royals reliever Dan Quisenberry and whether or not he should be in the Baseball Hall of Fame. And joining us in just a moment is senior writer from The Athletic, Joe Poznanski. But before we bring Joe on, let's talk a little more about Dan. So Dan Quisenberry didn't play in the MLB for a very long time. He played from 1979 to 1990, mainly for the Kansas City Royals, but he really made his time in the MLB count. He was a submarine pitcher who could barely throw, I think, really over 85 miles per hour. Was not topping out at 90 at any point of his career, I don't think, on the fastball. But he had a quite the remarkable career as a closer for the Royals. Over the course of his career, he had a 24.6 WAR. He was 56-46 with a 2.76 ERA. He pitched in 674 games, collected 244 saves over 1,043 innings, and had 379 strikeouts with a 1.175 whip. But this is where it gets really interesting, right? So Quisenberry, in the last 50 years, has the fifth lowest ERA. Only Mariano Rivera, Clayton Kershaw, Jake DeGrom, and Hoyt Wilhelm have lower ERAs. In the last 50 years, only Josh Tomlin has a better walks per nine inning ratio. And then when we talk about awards, he won the Rolaids Relief Award five different times. He was a three-time All-Star, 1985 World Series champ with the Royals. He led the MLB in saves five times, games finished four times, and was top five in Cy Young voting five times, and top 10 in MVP voting four times. And even though his saves numbers of 244 seems very low today, when he retired, he was top 10 all time. And he actually set the record for most saves in a season in 1983 with 45, which again, today, doesn't seem like a lot, but back then, obviously, it was a record. And when Quisenberry was in the league in his prime, and I'll go with this through with Joe in just a second, but had one of the better stretches for a closer in MLB history, if not the best. And again, Joe and I will discuss this in just a moment. So Dan Quisenberry, Hall of Fame candidate, is being talked about today. He was on the ballot only once in 1996, fell off immediately with 3.8% of the vote that year. So came on, came right back off. So it's really up to the modern era baseball committee to get him in. They kind of just recently voted. So their next vote is December 2023 to be a part of the class of 2024. So we got a bit of time before then. Now I'll probably be able to play this December 2023. So if you're listening 2023, welcome to the podcast. But those are the quick facts on Quisenberry. And again, we're going to get into all these numbers and a lot more with Joe. So with all those quick facts out of the way, let's bring on Joe. All right. So I'd like to welcome to the podcast today, senior writer for The Athletic, Joe Poznanski. Joe, how are you doing today?
I am doing great.
Well, I appreciate you joining. And Joe is joining us here today to talk baseball. We are talking about the Hall of Fame candidacy of Dan Quisenberry, who, of course, was one of the great relievers of the early times when relievers were becoming popular for those Kansas City Royals. And, you know, Dan fell off the ballot after the first year. He came on the ballot in 96. He only got 3.8% of the vote, so he fell off. If you're a Kansas City Royal fan listening today, you might also remember that his teammate on those Royals teams, Frank White, also got 3.8% and fell off that year. So not a good year for the Kansas City Royals players. But, you know, he still has a chance. So over the years, the modern era baseball committee votes every so often. The next time they vote is in December 2023 for the inclusion of the 2024 class. So if you're listen to this pod in 2023, because I'm replaying it again, because he might be, you know, one of the people being voted on. Welcome to the pod. But, you know, Joe, I ask everyone that comes on this podcast when we're talking about a certain player, this first question right off the bat. But Joe, when you think of Dan Quisenberry, what's the first thing that comes to your mind?
Well, that's a tough one because Dan was a lot of things. You know, for me, the first thing that comes to mind with Dan is going to be different than if we were doing this about, you know, Mini Minoso or you know, any other player who is, you know, had a great career and we're talking about the Hall of Fame. I mean, I knew Dan. We became friends toward the end of his life. And of course, he died young, which was very difficult. And you know, I'm friends with his family. So for me, the first thing that comes to mind with Dan Quisenberry was his personality, his character. He was an incredibly decent, funny, thoughtful person. He was a poet. And so I think about the personal side of Dan, rather than him on the field. But of course, you know, when you think about Dan, you think about the great submarining pitching style that he had. You know, you think about those dominant years when the Royals were great and he was closing out games. I mean, you think about a lot of things for him on the field, but for me, it's more of a personal connection that I have with Dan, and he really was just a wonderful, wonderful person.
Yeah, if you from any of the things I've read, or again, I wasn't really alive when he was playing, but anything you can see, he just looks like the model teammate, kind of the team prankster, the guy that's kind of calm in the bullpen. I think that's someone. That's kind of a personality trait you probably want, someone who is calm and under pressure. And from his, you know, statistics, and we'll talk about a little later, but a 6-year stretch he really put together. One of the better relievers, honestly, statistically and honestly accolade wise, we've really ever seen. But you talked about he pitched in some big games, some big moments for those early 80s Royals teams that, you know, won 2 pennants, won a World Series in 85. That kind of segues perfectly, Joe, into our next segment here. We call this That Memorable Moment. And what we try to do in this segment is pinpoint, you know, what is the most memorable moment, defining moment of the player's career? So this could be a specific game, a playoff series, or even a whole season. If I had, and this might be a loaded question, but if I had asked you what is his most memorable moment, what would you say?
Well, it would, you know, it's hard for me. It is hard with him to pinpoint a specific moment. I mean, obviously pitched, you know, quite often in the playoffs. I mean, in, you know, he pitched in 2 different World Series. He, you know, was the guy that closed things out a couple of different times. He was, you know, I guess it would be 85. I guess it would be, you know, that his pitching in the World Series in 85, when the Royals finally won the World Series after years of, you know, almost, but no, but not quite. So, you know, I would guess that there would be, it's interesting with him. He doesn't have sort of a George Brett Pine Tar moment that I can think of where he had like one at bat. I mean, you know, he had these epic at bats that he would face against Reggie Jackson or against, you know, Rod Carew or one of the great, great players of the time. But it's interesting. I don't know that I would be able to pick sort of one specific moment for him. I think it was much more a series of moments for him and a series of famous quotes. I mean, that was the other thing about him, was that in many ways he was as famous for the things he said after games as he was for what he did on the field.
Yeah. And of course, you know, game 6 of the 1985 World Series, he gets the win, pitches 1.1 innings, a shutout ball to force game 7. And of course that was the game where the Royals scored 2 runs in the 9th to win that game, to force that game 7. So I kind of, you know, pinpointed that. And then the other thing, Joe, I want to talk about here, this is honestly, I know this is not the World Series, but still the ALCS, 1980 ALCS. I kind of want to call this out. In game 2, it's October 9th, he gets the save and a 3-2 win over the Yankees. That's great. But then he comes back and pitches the next night, and that's something he did all the time, pitch back-to-back nights.
Sure.
in multiple innings, right? Pitchers don't do that anymore in relief. At least closers don't. But it's really game three of that. October 10th, so it's the next day after he gets a save. Royals win 4-2 over the Yankees. This is the game that takes them to the World Series, actually, in 80. He comes in and pitches 3.2 innings of relief to close out the game. Again, we're not going to see that again. Our analyst Chapman's not pitching 3.2 innings to close out a game. No. My closer, Crimble, if the Cubs can ever get to the ninth with a save situation, maybe he could actually pick up a save at this point. But anyway, he pitched 3.2 innings of relief to close out the game. In the eighth inning, this is what really got me. A leadoff triple. He walks the next two batters, and there's no outs. Bases loaded. And he gets out of the inning. He forces a double play, which he did time and time again throughout his career. And then he got Jim Spencer to ground out, got out of that inning. And again, they won that game, got to the World Series. And then to kind of extend that, Joe, when he got to the World Series in 1980, he pitched in every single game of that World Series, all six games, including four of the six games he pitched over two innings. I don't know if we will. I mean, do you think in history, I know we say things like Joe DiMaggio's 56 game hit streak, that's never going to be touched again. You could say other records, maybe someone will never hit over 400 again. Will anyone ever pitch every game of a World Series again?
Certainly not multiple innings. I mean, you know, that's never going to happen. Yeah. What's so interesting about the game that sent them to the World Series, that game against the Yankees in the ALCS, he came into that game and gave up back-to-back hits and a couple of runs in that game. They were up 1-0, and he actually gave up the lead in that game. But the Royals had such confidence and faith in him, they kept him in the game, and he finished it out. And as you said, he had the bases loaded. He gave up the line drive double play. He got the line drive double play. I think it was Rick Cerrone who hit into it. And, you know, he was the guy, and that doesn't happen ever. I mean, if any reliever comes into a game now and gives up a lead, he's out. That's it. You wouldn't trust that person to get you through the rest of the game. But with Quiz, and of course it was a different time, but you look at Quiz's like seasons and look at the numbers of innings that he pitched. I mean, that year, I'm looking it up now, he pitched 128 innings. I mean, that's a starter now. That's, you know, and he was doing that in relief. He pitched 136 innings in 82, 139 innings in 83. I mean, this is double what closers do now, more than double. I mean, these guys pitch 58, 60 innings. He's pitching more than double that as a closer. It was a different time, but he was also an incredibly unique pitcher because of the way he pitched. And he was indestructible. I mean, he would just go out there day after day.
Yeah, the innings pitched is, I think, tough for a baseball fan of today, especially someone just starting to follow baseball today, to kind of understand. He, as you said, he between 1980 and 1985, he pitched over 128 innings every season except the strike shortened season in 81. And honestly, 128 innings sometimes is like what a fifth starter does, honestly, right, in today's game. And this is a reliever we're talking about. The two-inning save is something he did all the time. And that's not like the few times I've been even aware of a two-inning save in my lifetime are very few. And this was a common occurrence with him. And it could be because his fastball, what would you say, Joe? Did it top out at like 81 miles per hour or?
Yeah, I'm not sure he was even in the 80s all the time. I mean, he was that, you know, but it was a sinking fastball. It's what he threw. And he really didn't strike out very many people. I mean, it's a much different environment. But was, you know, the thing that was so amazing about him, and I've written about this at length, he never, ever, ever beat himself, ever. So, you know, he didn't just not walk people. I mean, it was historic how few people he walked. I mean, unintentionally, he walked almost nobody. He didn't give up home runs because of a sinking ball. He got more double plays per capita probably than just about anybody in the history of the game. He never balked. He never threw, you know, never hit a batter. I mean, he just was a guy that never beat himself, you know, time and time again. I mean, it's the guy threw four wild pitches in his entire career. So he was a very unique guy, but you're right. I mean, it wasn't just two inning saves. It was three inning saves. It was more than three inning saves. I mean, he was pitching more innings at different times than like today's opener. Right. I mean, you know, the guys today who just start the game to try to get the thing rolling. So, He was incredible, and he was obviously a guy that his style and his role will never be repeated.
No, it won't. And as you said, barely walked anyone. I was looking like last 50 years. If you count intentional walks, he still has the second best, you know, nine inning ratio in terms of walks, only about 1.39 walks per nine innings. And if you take out intentional walks, it's even lower.
That's crazy.
And then if you look at ERA, right, it's not just he wasn't, you know, he was getting out of innings, he was getting saves. He's the, in the last 50 years, only four players have lower ERAs than him. And two of them are still playing today. And by the end of their careers, they might be higher. And that's Kershaw and DeGrom. The other two with lower ERAs are surefire Hall of Famers, relievers, including Mariano Rivera. So we're talking about someone from again, and I want to get to this in a little bit, but from what he did on the field to his numbers back it up, it's really just an unorthodox type of player in terms of not overpowering stuff, especially in today's game where every reliever has to throw 103 miles per hour.
Right.
He's the exact opposite, but he did, you know, balls came in play, and the Kansas City Royals had a great defense back then, and they could take care of the ball when it got into play and it got him out of innings. But Joe, the last kind of mini segment here before we talk strictly about the case for, case against his Hall of Fame candidacy, we call this "And Twins."
Ah, no! Quarterbacks eating dirt, pom poms and short skirts, fans who won't quit, and those Twins.
And what we try to do for "And Twins," we just talked about how he was a very uncommon player. But if you had to look at the Hall of Fame today, Cooperstown today, and look at maybe the Hall of Fame relievers already in there, either playing style, which you're probably not going to go with because his playing style was so different than everyone, but maybe numbers-wise or just impact on the game-wise, who in the Hall of Fame today do you think most closely resembles Quiz in terms of play or terms of statistics?
Yeah, it's super easy, super-duper easy, because I've written about this many, many times. Nobody's style of play. I mean, you know, he was a unique player, and there's nobody in the Hall of Fame. There are very few people, you know, in the history of the game that tried to do it the way he did it. But from a number standpoint, from an impact standpoint, it's a guy that was a contemporary of his, and that's Bruce Sutter. There's absolutely no question. I have done quite a bit of statistical work on this. They're basically the same. Their impacts are almost identical, and they did it very, very differently. Of course, I mean, Sutter was a strikeout pitcher with the great split finger fastball that he popularized, but you know, and he had more saves because at the end of his career he played for the Braves, and even though he wasn't really a great player anymore, he picked up a bunch of saves that didn't mean a whole lot. But other than that, it's identical, absolutely identical. I mean, you look at the way that they impacted the game, the dominance that they had, the impact they had on the postseason, the impact they had on the regular season. It's stunning how close they are as far as that goes.
Yeah. So Sutter's who I had down as well. I rarely match up with my guests, so it's great. But as you said, this was kind of an easy one.
Yeah.
And you're exactly right. And it's anyone listening today, we're not going to go through all the numbers number by number, but go on, you know, Baseball Reference and take a look, because it's quite astonishing. I mean, if you really want to go head to head, you know, Dan had a higher WAR, had a better ERA, pitched in more games, pitched more innings, had more Royal Aid Relief awards. They both led the league in save five times.
Right.
Dan led the league in finished games, though, four times. Bruce only did that once. And then if you look at Cy Young's and MVPs, again, almost identical. Dan was top five in the Cy Young Award five times. Bruce was top five in the Cy Young Award four times. And then in terms of MVP finishes, Bruce was top 10 five times. And then Dan was top 10 four times. So one less there. The only difference really is Suter won a Cy Young, actually. Right. You know, Dan was runner-up twice, got third place twice, never won one. But here's the thing I got to ask you, Joe, right? So almost identical, if not Dan is beating him in most categories here. However, you know, Quiz fell off the ballot in 96, 3.8%. That year, Suter was on the ballot for his third season. He came on the ballot in 94. In 94, he received 24%. In 96, when Dan's falling off, Suter is getting 29.1% of the vote. And eventually, you know, he gets in year 13 with 76.9%. Joe, what happened there? What like, other than, you know, Suter was a strikeout guy. He has the Cy Young. I guess he has the physical hardware. But in the, you know, you're a voter. What's the holdup there? How can someone think that much higher of one pitcher than the other when they're pitching basically at the same exact time? And honestly, one of the pitchers honestly had, for the most part, better numbers across the board than the other. Yet he didn't get in. The other got in. What's going on there?
Well, it's something I've spent a lot of time thinking about. And you know, I think it comes down to a couple of things. I think one is what you said. I mean, he was a flashier pitcher. He was more of a strikeout pitcher. He did win a Cy Young. That's a big deal. I mean, just even though, you know, Quiz finished runner up a couple of different times and really probably, you know, looking back on it, I'm not saying that a reliever should win the Cy Young, but he was beaten by starters that did not have especially great years in a couple of cases. But I think him winning the Cy Young and him being a strikeout pitcher, I think there was this sense. The thing that's very interesting, and I know you've talked about this on this show because you know it's such a big part of what the Hall of Fame is. If you have a story behind you, if you have something that is like a hook, it really makes a huge difference when it comes to the Hall of Fame. And I think the hook for Bruce Suter was that he was such a vital part of creating the split-fingered fastball that became such a big part of baseball. And of course, it's not nearly as big a part anymore, but you know, people might remember there was a time when Mike Scott and Roger Clemens and a bunch of other guys, I mean, it was maybe the dominant pitch in the game, certainly one of the dominant pitches in the game. And he played a huge role in that. I mean, he was one of the first to throw it, and he was certainly the first great pitcher to throw it. And you look at his amazing Cy Young year with the Cubs, you know, it was earth-shattering to see a guy come on the scene like that. And I think he got a lot of credit for that. And, of course, Quiz didn't really influence other people to become, you know, 75 mile an hour submariners, right? I mean, that was something that was pretty limited. So I think that was a big part of the story. I think it was, you know, he was more of a strikeout pitcher. He was more famous, I guess, in his own way. I mean, Quiz was always such an understated, modest guy, and not that Suter isn't, but he was a bigger presence. And I think that split-fingered fastball, I know I heard a lot. I was not a voter yet, but I know I heard a lot of people talking about, oh, he changed the game, you know, and I kind of don't buy it, to be perfectly honest with you, not to say that he was, you know, he threw a split-fingered fastball. It's great. But that was certainly a big part of why he was the one that got so much more than Quiz did. And it's wrong. I don't think it's right. And I also know, and you know this, it's hard to get into the Hall of Fame. I'm not sure. Relievers other than, you know, these titanic Mariano Rivera types should get in the Hall of Fame. I mean, it's really, you know, it's tough. They don't pitch as many innings and they don't do so many different things. But what I cannot make sense of is Bruce Suter's a Hall of Famer and Dan Quisenberry is off the ballot first year. It doesn't make any sense at all to me.
Yeah. And you know, you go through any ballot and there's people that fall off after that first year. And it's pretty shocking. And sometimes the ballot's just full. And, you know, I looked at 96 and it was a pretty stacked ballot. A lot of those 90s, 2000s ones were. Most are. I mean, again, as you said, I do this for basketball, football, baseball. Baseball is by far the hardest Hall of Fame to get into.
Sure.
Some players that a certain fan base might think, oh, he has a really good shot, they fall off right away. And I'm sure Kansas City Royal fans were probably a little shocked that he fell off. And him and Frank White fell off after 1 year and he couldn't even stay on. Right. So, and again, it's the hardest one to get into. Relievers are tough. I'm glad you kind of talked a little bit about that because I think recently they've been getting a little more love and there's been getting more and more getting in, which is why I think it's important to kind of bring Dan up so he's not forgotten. Because in the 80s, he really was. I mean, he's the first guy to ever have back-to-back 40 save seasons.
Right.
He set the record for most saves in a season when he hit 45. Now, I know 45 seems like a top 10 finish in today's game, but you know, back then that had never been done before. So I always look at it as when he finished his career, where is he at? Because you said earlier, right, 244 saves. That's going to be a little lower than most Hall of Famers.
Sure.
But when he retired, I believe he was sixth all time. So yeah. It's just a different game. So I do want to move to our final segment here, Joe. We did cover a lot of this already, but we call this court.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth.
You can't handle the truth.
And really, this is where we talk more about, you know, the case for, case against. We've been kind of going back and forth on several things that's for a quiz right now and against. But there's one thing I want to run by you here. So I was looking at his career. I think one of the big knocks on him, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's probably that his career was pretty short. Mm-hmm. You know, 1979 to 90, a lot of players, you know, you can have great stretches and then just not put up the all-time numbers and you just get cut. I mean, baseball is a game where I think we look at, you know, accumulation here. How much did he collect over the course? You got to have sustained success. And in the NFL, you can be a running back and have four great seasons and get in.
Right.
Not the same for baseball so much.
Yeah. However, that's right.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I think that's right. I mean, look, I think he was a truly great pitcher for six seasons. I mean, you know, it's on either end. He didn't come up until he was older because it's not easy to get a call to the big leagues when you throw 80 miles an hour. And so, you know, he from 80 to 86, 80 to 85, 86, he was still very good, not quite as good. He also, by the way, you know, had in his prime at his very best, he had, you know, maybe his best season ever shortened by the strike, which is a real ripoff for him. I mean, I think 81 could have been a year that he could have won the Cy Young. It could have been a year that he could have, you know, done some things that would have pushed his case a little higher, but it is a short career. There's no question. He got in late. And he really sort of fell off young. I mean, he was, you know, in his mid 30s when he really was no longer effective. So it's a big knock. It is. It just, you know, now I'm of the belief that I look much, much more at peak value than I do at you know, the length of a career. I do not like when I see a dominant player, you know, being saying, okay, well, he's not a Hall of Famer because he didn't have those average to below average seasons on both ends to create. You know, one of the things we talked about Bruce Sutter, one of the things that Bruce Sutter ended up having was 300 saves, which was, you know, now is not anything, but at the time was kind of a magic number. And again, he got 300 saves because at the end of his career, he played for the Braves and picked up a whole lot of cheap saves for a pretty bad team. And, you know, nothing wrong with that, of course, but it doesn't add to his Hall of Fame case. I mean, to me, Bruce Sutter at his best, that's the question, whether or not he was a Hall of Famer. And I think it's the same thing with Dan. He did not add a whole bunch of cheap saves. I mean, at the end of his career, I think in his last 4 or 5 years, he probably added 15 saves or something like that. He never really was, he wasn't really a closer after he left Kansas City. And, you know, that sort of hurt him probably when it came to people looking at his numbers. It's a short career, but I like looking at peak value.
Yeah. And if you're, and Joe, if you're looking someone that looks at peak value, I mean, that's what I was actually getting to. I did a lot of homework here on this one area because it's all, I mean, I think Dan's case really, it's going to be about his peak and that stretch from 80 to 85, including that strike season. I was looking at 5-year stretches of pretty much all the top closers in MLB history. And historically, I could only find two pitchers that were in the realm of the quizzes 1980 to 85 stretch. And if you really have them side by side, he kind of finishes ahead of them. Again, from 80 to 85, five top five Cy Young seasons, including two runners up, two third place finishes, four top 10 MVP seasons, including a third place finish. I don't know, a relief pitcher getting third place in the MVP cracks me up nowadays, but back then it probably made sense. And then this is where it really gets, you know, led the league in saves five of the six seasons. The only season he didn't was the strike shortened seasons, five of six seasons, and leading the league in saves five seasons. That's most all time. If you're looking at like the last 100 years, earlier on when people were getting like three saves, it wasn't really a stat. I don't really count that. But then, you know, led the league in games, finished four of those six seasons, pitched over 128 innings, five of those six seasons. And then five of those seasons, he had under an ERA of 2.64. And then he basically walked no one, helped the Royals win two pennants, one World Series. The only other two guys that had similar stretches were Suter and Eckersley. And if you really look at them, I mean, Dan comes on top. So I have him down as the best, you know, 6 year, it was a 6 year stretch, 80 to 85, best 6 year stretch of a reliever in MLB history. You know, Joe, I know you say peak matters. I feel like that helps in your eyes, but as a voter, as a Hall of Fame voter, do a majority of voters see it your way in terms of peak value, at least in today's, you know, room of voters, or do a lot more voters value, hey, you need to be great or at least very good for a very long time to get my vote?
I think it's, well, I mean, look, I think the fact that he fell off the ballot first year, I mean, things haven't changed that much. You know, I mean, I think the majority of voters would say you need both. You need to have great peak value and you need to have great longevity. I mean, that's what makes the Baseball Hall of Fame so hard. I mean, I've also, like you, I've looked hard at the Football Hall of Fame and longevity. I mean, there are people in the Football Hall of Fame, as you well know, who got there because of longevity, Charlie Joyner, guys like that, who got there because they put up career numbers and maybe their peak value wasn't as high as others, but most of them are in there because they were great players for 3, 4, 5 seasons. I mean, quarterbacks a little bit more, but that's basically what we're talking about. We're talking about Terrell Davis's of, you know, for when it comes to the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Basketball Hall of Fame is somewhat similar in that way. Baseball Hall of Fame is the one that really looks at those. Okay, did you get 3,000 hits? Did you get 300 wins? Did you get 500 homers? Did you get this? Did you get this? And, you know, with relievers, it's really, really tough. Mm-hmm. I mean, those guys, I think the thing that's crazy is, let's say you look at those three that you're talking about, Suter, Eckersley, Quisenberry, okay, as the greatest 5-year stretches, and then throw in a Mariano or a modern player, sure, Trevor Hoffman. He threw 200 more innings than those guys, even Suter, even guys like that, even Eckersley. I mean, he just threw so many more innings. And it's funny that you say, because I've done exactly the same thing where I go, you know, between 1980 and 85, he led the league in saves 5 out of 6 times, and he did this 5 out of 6 times. And the year that he didn't was the strike year. So, I mean, it's really every year from 1980 to 85, he led the league in saves. Every year from 1980 to 85, you know, he was an MVP candidate. Every year he was a Cy Young candidate. And, you know, he had the 1 year in the middle that I think kind of messes up the the way it looks. He messes up the visual, but the reality is that from 80 to 85, he was one of the most important and best players in baseball as a reliever, which is unbelievably hard to do. So to answer your question, I don't think most people view it the way I do. I think most people put a lot more stock in career value than I would. I get it. I certainly understand that baseball does demand both, you know, short-term and long-term excellence. And I respect that. But I just think, you know, you add, you know, 50, 60 saves on either end of his career, and he would have been a much more serious Hall of Fame candidate. And I don't think that makes him any better a pitcher.
No, and the saves thing, I think, does kill him, especially today. Today's voters, you know, you're looking at the save totals, and
right.
We got 600, 500, 400. Everyone's over two. I mean, pitchers today can get over 244 and, I don't know, seven, eight, nine years, seasons,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But again, if your eyes only gravitate to that, I don't think you think you're doing a disservice to everything else, and it's across the board. He's filling up the entire line there, and I think this is where innings pitch matter a lot. I think the walk ratio matters a lot.
Yep.
Again, I think it comes down to, right, Joe, nothing against the quiz, but, you know, he wasn't sexy here, right? The strikeouts weren't there. He wasn't flashy, but I, you know, part of me, I want to look at, like, you know, he was a unicorn in his own right, right? Like, everyone loves talking about unicorns in the NBA, players you've never seen. Like, he pitched in the very low, you know, 80s, 70s, with a submarine style pitch, didn't strike anyone out, but he got everyone out.
Yeah.
And that's not something you see much. And it does make him unique in his own way, not in a sexy way, but in his own way. And I don't know. I don't think people appreciate it enough. Maybe.
No, I think that's right. I think unicorn is a great word for him. I mean, and I do think you can compare him to certain, you know, NBA players, you know, that they sort of were different, and there was no, you know, we're not really, you couldn't really copy who they were. I think that's right. With him, you know, with Mariano, the fact that he threw one pitch was made him a legend, right? I mean, everybody talks about the Mariano cutter. Quiz threw one pitch. He didn't have a curveball, you know? I mean, he threw that one sinker. He put it exactly where he wanted time after time after time. And you know, and he got beat. But he was always, you know, he would come back and obviously the team had such faith and confidence in him to come back and put him in crazy situations. That's the other thing, is he came in to games, you know, that wasn't the time where they really did call those guys firemen, you know, I mean, he would come into games all the time with bases loaded, two on, then he would, you know, be expected to clean up that mess and then pitch the last two innings of the game after that. Right. So it was a different time, and it's very difficult, I think, to get people to appreciate the time that it was, right? It's very difficult to get people to understand that the game used to be this way because now it's this way. And so the good thing with Quiz is that it really won't come down to the baseball writers. It won't come down to a huge vote. Instead, it will come down to these committees, and he has been on the ballots before. So the opportunity is there for people to really dig into who Dan Quisenberry was.
Yeah. And that leads me, Joe, to the final verdict here. So I'm going to ask you two questions here, and then I'm going to answer them myself. The first question is, do you think Dan Quisenberry should be in Cooperstown? And then my second question to you will be, do you actually think he will ever get into Cooperstown?
Yeah. Well, I do think he should be in Cooperstown. I would vote for him. I think he should be. I think the kind of player that he is, that he was, the kind of person that he was, I just think he makes the Hall of Fame a better place. I think Bruce Sutter is in there, and I think Dan Quisenberry should be in there with him. Will he get into the Hall of Fame is much tougher, and being brutally honest, I don't see how it happens. I'm not saying it won't. Momentum can shift, but You know, unless somebody decides to take him on as a cause, and I mean somebody within the voting realm, you know, I know that he's been on the ballot, as I mentioned, and the veterans ballot, and I don't think he got any votes. I just there's so many great players with better sort of statistical cases. You know, as you've said, you look at his numbers now, and yeah, they pale. I mean, it's 1,000 innings pitched and 244 saves, and you know, you're gonna have to make a really, really powerful case. You're gonna have to dig deep into who he was and what the impact he was, and I just think the odds are against that.
Yeah, I this makes for a boring podcast, but I believe I agree with you on both points.
Yeah.
I do think he's a Hall of Famer. The peak there, again, I think he had one of the better peaks in history of a reliever. And you look at some of the people that have gone in, and I just can't look past, you know, the ERA, the amount of innings he pitched, as well as the hardware. I know he didn't pick all of it up, but he was in the discussion for MVP, for Cy Young, so many years. And as a reliever, the thing, Joe, the one number I was kind of saving for the end here that really impresses me, and again, this is nothing anyone talks about probably at a bar, maybe outside of Kansas City, but if you look at the number of shares of Cy Young votes he has in his career, so he finished second twice, third twice, he was top five all those years. He's 38th all-time in Cy Young Award shares.
Amazing.
That's the highest of any reliever in MLB history. It's higher than Eckersley. He's 50th. Smoltz, 54th, who also had starter Cy Young Award votes. Suter was 55th. Trevor Hoffman, 58th. Rivera, 61st. Even Nolan Ryan's behind him, okay? So for 38th all-time in MLB history across starters, relievers, that stands out to me enough, along with how low his ERA was, the number of times he led the leagues in what relievers are supposed to do, saves. I know he doesn't have the career, but five times leading the league. I think he is a Hall of Famer by the definition of what I've seen relievers get into the Hall of Fame at this point. I do not think he's going to get in, though. You know, I've seen plenty of people build momentum over the years and have all these backers. I think it would take a very big, I don't know, social media push at some point, or someone to really, you know, take the case and put it out there. But you made a really good point. There is, we talked about it earlier, Cooperstown is very hard to get into. There are a lot of great, great players that I've covered on this podcast and still have to in the future that did not get their time, that fall off the ballot after a couple years. He's probably very, very in the back of the line in terms of people waiting to get in. And in that case, I don't think a reliever is going to get that bump anytime soon. So I agree with you. I think he's a Hall of Famer, but I do not think he gets to into Cooperstown, at least probably in my lifetime. So again, boring podcast when we both agree at the end, but it happens sometimes. Joe, I want to thank you for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate the time. Listeners, you know, if you don't already read Joe on The Athletic, he writes excellent stuff. And then Joe, I believe you have a book coming out pretty soon, right? Do you want to talk about that real quick?
Happy to talk about that. Yes. September 28th. The book is The Baseball 100, and it is a countdown, of the 100 greatest players in baseball history. And, it is very long. It is, I can promise you, you will not feel like you got cheated, because it is very long, but I loved it. It is 100 essays, literally, of the 100 greatest players as I see them in order. And, I think people will like it. I hope they will.
I listeners of the podcast, if you listen to this, I trust me, you will love that. I read Joe's stuff all the time. It's excellent. I'm excited for that book coming out this fall. Joe, again, appreciate the time. Good luck with the book release. And you have a great rest of your week.
Excellent. Thank you.
All right. So I want to thank Joe again for coming on the podcast. Really enjoyed talking about Dan Quisenberry today and his Hall of Fame candidacy. And we'll have to see if one day he does get in. I do feel like he is one of the more underrated players and underappreciated players in MLB history. And I'm glad we had the chance to talk about him today. As Joe just mentioned, you know, check out his book, pre-order it. Comes out in a couple months here. And if you don't already, I can't stress enough, read Joe on The Athletic. He wrote a series of essays last summer, 100 Greatest Players in MLB History. And it was a new player every day. And it was like during the peak of the quarantine last year. And I looked forward to it every morning, and it was excellent. You can read it anytime you want. I mean, it's the 100 best players of all time, just like you can listen to this podcast anytime you want. So go check out Joe's writing on The Athletic. But that's all I have today. So per usual, if you don't already, please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Follow us on Twitter, and we will talk to you next Monday. Thanks.